you do still find a little bit of a kind of not invented here syndrome. So within companies, although they're much better at that and much more open to that, there's still a little bit of that mentality we see. And some of that is understandable because, and we see it with a lot of university IP where we're trying to partner with that. And the university's got some great data, maybe have some test data in a model system or something, but that's a long way off what a company would consider active or whatever its criteria is. So
Okay.
that's where sometimes
Yeah.
that skepticism comes from.
Welcome to Innovation Talks. Join us weekly as we discuss with distinguished industry guests how to refine and improve corporate innovation and new product development. Hosted by Paul Heller, Sophion Chief Evangelist.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Glad you could join me again. I hope you're having a great week and you're starting to feel the joys of spring and flowers and being outside and nicer weather. And depending on what part of the world you're in and other parts of the world, I guess you're probably ending up wrapping up your summers. But thanks for joining us. My guest today is Rupert Osborne. And Rupert today is a managing director for Wellspring for the EMEA operation. But he has a strong background before that with a company that got acquired. The company was called IP Pragmatics. And they're really provide a lot of consulting and corporate and IP and technology transfer and just has a lot of good information. And I think it's very relevant to those of us working in innovation, especially as we think about working with potential partners. Innovation is no longer something we do ourselves. We need partners. We need startups. We need universities. We need help for certain types of innovation. And there's when you start to do that for real, issues crop up, and that's where Rupert helps companies. So, Rupert, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul. No, good to be here. And looking forward to our chat.
Yeah. And where are you calling in from?
I'm based at home at the moment. So, yeah, please excuse my messy living room behind me. No, so the office is based in London, but I live down in Somerset and spend a couple of days a week in the office, but also traveling, yeah. I guess, as we all do.
Yeah, customers are all over the place. Well, Rupert, tell us about your background, how you got into IP, how you got into innovation.
Yeah, I guess my journey probably is similar to a lot of people. So I wouldn't say I got into IP by accident, but I did a first degree at university, a PhD, decided I really didn't want to be an academic. I couldn't spend my life kind of looking into one area in depth. It was really the breadth and application of science that I enjoyed. Joined what was actually very briefly ICI, then became Zeneca, then became AstraZeneca on the research side. And through that, actually, that was my first sort of introduction to IP about patenting my research, our research, but then moved into a kind of business and licensing role. So helping set up collaborations and in and out licensing, jumped from there into a full license, a sort of independent licensing company. And it was from there that we founded IP Pragmatics. So it was a kind of gradual kind of drift into really not knowing anything about IP to actually setting up and having a business entirely focused on that.
Yeah, that's a great background. So when we think about IP, people might be quick to make an assumption on what it is, but maybe it's good to define what we mean by IP.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, so there's the sort of, if you like, legal definition, which is it's the sort of an asset created through a person's sort of intellect and an effort. And it is an asset. I think that's the thing that people maybe sometimes it's an intangible asset, but it's still an asset. So I say to people, it's like money in your bank account. It's like your car, your house. It's just a bit more intangible. I think the other thing with IP is a lot of people think IP equals patents or equals the registered right.
Right.
And they forget that actually there's trade secrets, there's know-how, there's copyright, there's a whole raft of different forms of IP. So we often work with clients and they're like, oh, we don't have any IP. And we're like, well, what do you mean? Well, we've got no patents. And we're like, yeah, but okay, but talk to me about your business and your processes. And it actually turns out they have a lot of IP. They just don't recognize it as that. So actually, yeah, when you get people thinking more broadly, then two things happen. One is they begin to appreciate those assets and maybe how they should kind of look after them a bit better and not just let employees walk in and out with them and tell their competitors, etc. But also they begin to then make a strategy about how they can build on that and maybe look for opportunities to sort of register that IP or have more formal rights as alongside, for example, the trade secrets or copyright that they may have.
Right. Yeah. And I'm thinking back to some early episodes in the podcast. We were talking about knowledge and innovation being a knowledge intensive business process. We were talking about corporate memory that gets built up, gets created during the innovation process and then can easily get lost.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you think in kind of, I'm going to say the old days, but you know, a lot of companies, it was in lab books, it was kind of written down, and certainly not centralized in a system or if it was only the final part. So there may be a 5-year research program, which ended up with finding a new drug or a new diagnostic or whatever, but that ends up being patented. And so, if you like, the sort of final capturing of that knowledge is within that patent filing. And at that point, it sort of enters, if you like, a sort of central system and gets registered. But you're right. I mean, earlier on in that process, it tended to be everything just sat within those research groups and certainly not accessible across research groups. And if those people left, you're right, a lot of that knowledge walked out the door with them. So I think, certainly the kind of change to having more sort of system-based approaches to that from an IT perspective really helps. And I think the other, I guess, big change that I've seen around that kind of related to that is most of those, if I think back to my early days of kind of in Zeneca, where, you know, we were doing research, we were collaborating. And I think certain industries were probably quicker or earlier to that kind of open innovation sort of approach than others. But even then, most of our activity was internal and we weren't, but to not the extent that you can do now, looking externally for those ideas or influencing of those ideas in a way that you can do now. Yeah. And I think that's the big change I see with kind of the IP. I mean, not just the kind of the sheer volume of IP that's out there and the sheer volume of innovation that's happening, but the more accessibility of that information.
Yeah.
We had every month, it was great. We used to get a printed printout of all of the patents that our patent department had found, which they thought were relevant for each of the research groups. And it was a very powerful tool, but you think, you know, that, and we're talking about early 90s now, to where we are now, where online, even through the sort of open systems like Aspasnet or the USPTO or et cetera, the amount of information that you can rapidly find around your area.
Yeah.
So, but that also brings challenges. It's how do you navigate that? How do you kind of understand that without kind of being completely, I don't know, put off or thrown by the sheer volume out there?
Right, right. People think, well, universities definitely are creating a lot of technology, a lot of IP, I guess, and companies are creating a lot of technology and IP. And so there's more than just it is a corporate problem as much as it is a university problem. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think if you look at the way companies, and this is a gross simplification, but used to think about IP, it was, we would sit there for, start a research program. We had a problem to solve. We would put a research program around that over however many period, it would come up with a solution to that, turn it into a product. And then at the end, it would think about IP. And if you think IP is in general, and part of the problem is IP is really a negative right. It actually, its role is to stop somebody else doing what you've protected or what you have. Mm-hmm. I think it was viewed that way as a sort of the final step of that journey is, oh, we better protect it. Whereas I think now that's still critical, but equally it's more of a circle. So actually that IP then generates kind of new ideas. But at the start of that process, it's using other people's IP and other knowledge that's out there actually is the starting point.
Yeah.
Not only for kind of where your ideas might come from, but the other aspect that's got so much more complicated and as a consequence of the kind of the tech world we live in is just the sheer number of third-party rights that you have to navigate. So, you know, your chances in, if you like, in the old days of developing a product, getting to the end and going, great, we'll protect it, and by the way, we're fine. The danger now is you do that. If you do that with your head in the sand, you come up with something that you find that actually you can't, even if you can protect, you can't use because it's infringing other people's rights. So that's the other thing, is thinking about IP at the beginning, both for, if you like, positive reasons, getting other ideas, where should I start? Let's not reinvent the wheel. Let's go and collaborate with the university or that startup. It's equally saying, well, if we're getting into that area, we need to do it with our eyes open because there's already a lot of patents, a lot of kind of third-party IP that we're going to have to navigate.
Yeah, yeah. Or use for speed, right? It used to be big companies made their own. Now you could be fast in the market. And I'm thinking as companies are shifting from the technology push model where, okay, we're going to create something, it's going to be so great, and then we're going to bring it to the world and find a use for it, versus the market pull model, which is there's a great opportunity and a need over here. Let's go build to that. Yes. Just your thoughts on how that's shifting things.
There's still a little bit of, and again, a gross simplification, but you do still find a little bit of a kind of not invented here syndrome. So within companies, although they're much better at that and much more open to that, there's still a little bit of that mentality we see. And some of that is understandable because, and we see it with a lot of university IP where we're trying to partner with that. And the university's got some great data, maybe have some test data in a model system or something. But that's a long way off what a company would consider active or whatever its criteria is. So that's where sometimes that skepticism comes from. But that doesn't stop you looking and using those ideas or even saying partnering and saying, okay, well, great, you've got it to that point. Actually, if we come and work with you, we can get it very quickly to this next point. And we've now saved 3, 4, 5 years of our own R&D effort. Corporates partnering with startups because in a way they're filling that gap between the university and the point at which the company, the corporate, can sort of have confidence in that idea to really invest, and that the startup is doing the middle heavy lifting for both parties, if you like.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm a software guy from my background and all. And we always dealt with the licensing of the open source movement came in with different licensing models, and some allowed you to just use it and some required you to, if you made a change, you had to submit your changes back, and any change you make or any derivative you made was owned by somebody. So there were all these different models. And I know that was complex, but that's got to be nothing compared to the world you're talking about.
Yeah, I think it is complicated, but I think it's, and that's where, again, I think the other big change around the IP world is the ability to use analytical tools and things to help with that. And it's definitely, it's interesting, the sort of AI, if you like, revolution that we're kind of right at the beginning of. One of the areas where that's definitely touching is the patent world, because if you think about it, doing an infringement search or a freedom to operate search, it's a matter of somebody eventually sitting down and trawling through patents and claims and descriptions and something that actually, and obviously using their intelligence and their experience to do that. But how much more efficient could that be done through an AI tool?
Yeah.
And even if it's not at that stage, at the earlier stage of the initial searching of finding, well, what is the landscape out there and what should I be looking at?
Yeah.
So that certainly is helping. There's charts people publish on the, if you like, the number of patents being filed per year and the growth of that, particularly in places like China, where the numbers are astonishing. And actually, if you do any sort of landscape mapping, most technology areas, probably 60, 70% of the patents you find are China, but China only.
Wow. Okay.
So, it's got the world's got more complicated, but in some sense, it's easier to navigate that world. But I look at it the other way around and say it's got more complicated. That equals more opportunity. There's more opportunity to find some really interesting innovation out there in places you would not historically look.
Yeah. For those of you who can access events in Australia, Jared Ryan is facilitating his next Idea to Launch Innovation Masterclass at the Melbourne Business School on the 30th of April and the 1st of May, 2024. For more information and to sign up, head to our events page at sophion.com/about/events or go to the Sophion website and search for a masterclass. I'm thinking about now content, and you see the New York Times suing OpenAI because you used our content to do something. And so all of a sudden, from the meaning of IP, just got a little broader in my mind.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that would be fascinating to see how that plays out. Yeah, in terms of the copyright rules and has that been information being copied or has it? Yeah, exactly.
And what industries, Rupert, when we talk about IP, and are there certain industries where it's there's more of it or it's more focused or there's more attention to it? Should I?
Yeah, I think if you, again, simplistic view, but I kind of look at the world in that way or try and break it down that way. I put it into three buckets. You've certainly got industries where historically, you know, and maybe it's something like brewing or industries where they have not historically gone near patents. It's really industries based on know-how, trade secret, the ability to kind of manufacture something, but they keep that secret source secret.
Yeah.
That's one bucket. And they're moving into kind of having to protect or thinking about IP in a different way. So that's one area. The second is, I would say, people like the pharmaceutical, the biotech industry, where IP is absolutely critical because you're not going to invest a couple of billion dollars to take a drug to market if a generic company can just manufacture the same thing. But in some sense, so critical, but in some sense it's simple because often you've got one or two patent families or a few patents covering that active ingredient or maybe its formulation. But essentially, that technology is almost kind of stands alone in a sense. So that's the sort of second bucket. So critical, IP critical, but in some senses, simple. And the third bucket is, and I would say that's in kind of electronics, it's telecommunications, it's mobile phones, where IP is not only important, but there is so much of it. I don't know I can't remember the figures, but you know, there's something like 4,000 essential patents cover 5G technology.
Wow.
But in a way, the world's got so complicated, and that's why that in that world, it's driven around standards, patent pooling, because there is no way that one company could ever navigate that massive thicket of IP. Having said that, you still see Apple and everybody suing each other. So it's complicated, but the industry's come up with ways to kind of solve some of that complication through things like patent pools. And because otherwise you would never develop a standard, because if everybody's got their patent covering part of that standard, you would get, nobody could move forward. So I think of those three pools. So you've got, and each of them have their challenges and their, if you like, the way they look at IP slightly differently.
I was watching a YouTube video this morning, as sometimes I do, and there was a group of people that were doing a CT scan of a $130 Apple cable, I think, for their Thunderbolt 4 or whatever, doesn't matter, and a $13 cable from Amazon and a $3 cable from China. And you could just see everybody, the guys that were doing this, looking at the CT scan, was surprised at the amount of technology inside the Apple cable. And so when you see that and you see how much there is and what it's really doing versus a $3 knockoff, which has the company sells a million of them and then disappears because they're all junk. But the $130 cable had all this technology in it. It must have cost Apple a fortune to develop that. And so when you gave your pharma example, I just, again, but that's high tech again as well. So it's just, I see that. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing I think, so yeah, I guess the digital era has obviously brought in patents, as I said at the beginning, are important, but that's not the sort of be all and end all of IP. But yeah, so it's the kind of the other aspects of copyright and stuff and kind of and in a digital world, how do you navigate that? And the kind of AI in the New York Times example is the kind of next step on that. I don't know, you and I are old enough to remember photocopiers and going to the photocopy machine, and there was always a copyright notice next to it that said, look, you can take one copy for your own use and that's fine. But in a digital world, completely, how do you control that? And that's the other side, I think, of IP, is how the legal framework is kind of catching up with technology development and sometimes falling behind. Yes.
What role do governments play in this, Rupert?
Yeah, interesting. I think, again, if you look at, take the UK Patent Office, you go back, I don't know, 30, 40 years, maybe 25 years, almost very passive. So they were there to help you get a patent right. So very administrative, really, but not really playing a proactive role of sort of saying, actually, we should be helping the nation think about IP, maximize its assets. And that has really fundamentally shifted. So patent offices around the world now are doing a fantastic job with education, helping small companies kind of navigate the IP world on the one hand, but equally, you see it through changes of legislation. So things like patent box that's come in certain countries, and I know is kind of controversial in some senses, but if you like, you can see that the other way around. It's trying to turn IP from not just being a negative right that the company holds to stop others competing with what you're doing, but actually turn it the other way to saying it can also has a positive, even in the negative effect, if you like, it's positive because it helps that company grow. But patent box was a way of recognizing benefit in another direct way, which is, look, you can save on your tax. If you've got IP that covers a product, you're going to pay a lower corporation tax. So things like that, again, encouraging people to think about IP, because ultimately, and again, there's some good publications out there looking at similar companies, and the ones where they take a strong view on IP generally have a stronger competitive position, higher profit margins, bigger market share. So that in general, I think, again, where governments have done a good job in thinking how they can use the, if you like, the central IP framework to encourage of that direct economic benefit and growth.
Great. Yeah. Rupert, do you have a favorite IP example in all the work you've done? And you could anonymize it if you need to, or not expose any confidentiality, but is there one that you kind of, oh, that's a fun story?
No, yeah, I don't know about fun. I mean, I think one of the challenges of IP is just, but it's not a reason not to think about it, is just how much stuff never makes it to market. So, and because a lot of what we do is very early stage support, then actually the chances of getting that all the way through, I mean, it's not quite buying a lottery ticket and seeing it to market. But no, one of the projects that we've been involved with, I've been involved with for a while, and it's in the public domain, I think it's a great story for a number of reasons. And it's to do with developing a whole new vaccine platform for a really nasty animal health disease called foot and mouth disease, which is endemic in certain parts of the world, eradicated and not present in others. But if it gets into Europe, into the UK, into the US, devastating effect. And FMD, foot and mouth disease vaccines, have real issues because they're historically based on you have to grow the virus up, kill it in a sense, and use that for vaccination. Causes problems because you're actually now having to grow up a huge amount of a very nasty virus, one hand. On the other hand, actually, some of those killed viruses are not very good. So a long-term project, originally actually funded by the Wellcome Trust with a number of institutes in the UK and universities, looking at a completely different way of building a sort of a viral vector, in a sense, platform, an empty capsid platform. So no infectious virus, much more stable. And a really lovely combination because there's been some brilliant science, structural biologists at Oxford looking to how the structure of the virus and where you could change to make it more stable. Brilliant biology going on at Reading and at the Purbright Institute to kind of understand how that then impacts on a vaccine. And then with MSD Animal Health, getting involved and taking that forward. And so it's been probably getting on for a 14-year journey with that team.
Wow.
And it's coming up close to, hopefully, fingers crossed, in a couple of years' time to making it to market. And in a way, has the potential to dramatically change the way vaccination is used against that disease, and particularly in places like Africa, where some of the strains which are there have the poorest performing vaccines and therefore big impact on cattle and persistence farming, et cetera. So that's to me it's just a really nice story because we've been part of it along the way, but it's just a really nice combination of some fantastic science with meeting, okay, in this area, kind of an animal health need rather than a human health need, but an indirect human health need, because in parts of Africa, that the cattle and the sort of animals which are affected by the disease have a huge impact on kind of the livelihood of people as well.
Yeah, fascinating. Great example. Thanks for sharing. Yeah, and very humanitarian at the same time. So
as well as commercial, and obviously underpinned by a lot of both know-how, but also various patents and patent families, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Rupert, this has been a fun conversation. I really appreciate you sharing kind of some of the things you're working on. If you had to crystal ball, and maybe this is an unfair question, but where do you think things are going with respect to IP?
Yeah, no, interesting. Yeah, I think certainly the journey we're already on and a long way down of more and more companies seeing the value of IP and using IP both kind of offensively and defensively, I think that will continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm slightly, not fearful is too strong a word, but kind of interesting to see how the whole kind of AI and complexity of IP develops and whether that, I would hate us to get into such a situation where it's just too much of a quagmire that almost nobody knows where to start. And I think the other thing which I think has been great with IP is 20 years ago, probably very few people understood what IP was. Now, just the way my kids, they know what IP is. They watch investment shows like Dragon's Den, always talking about IP and the value of that. They recognize with brands and that. So I think that it's gone from being a sort of term specialist sort of think about to, I think, more of an everyday bit, which is good. That will continue.
Yeah, yeah. You're certainly working in a fun space, and like any space that's changing the way this one is and has this type of potential futures that you laid out, must be a fun place to work. If people want to follow kind of you and your group that you're kind of working with, your group there in the UK, what's the best way they can follow what you're doing or connect with you?
Yeah, no, welcome people connect with me on LinkedIn or obviously the Wellspring, both LinkedIn and I was going to say Twitter, but now X, I still can't get that in my head. But really happy to connect. But a lot of what we do is on the kind of the Wellspring website and various webinars and things which can access. So that would be the best way, but equally always happy for people to reach out to me directly on LinkedIn.
Great, great. Well, we'll make sure we put your contact, your LinkedIn profile information in our show notes so people know how to do that. Well, any final thoughts before we wrap up our session, Rupert? It's been a lot of fun for me.
Yeah, no, thank you. No, it's been, I enjoyed that. No, thank you very much for the opportunity. Yeah.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed that. That's a fun conversation to have with Rupert to come in and share his knowledge and expertise. I certainly learned a few things. So I want to thank you for joining us this week and wish you a great week ahead. Take care, everybody. Bye for now.
Thanks for joining us this week for Innovation Talks with Paul Heller. If you enjoyed the show, please like and subscribe on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, or wherever you listen to podcasts. For additional information on today's topic, check out sopheon.com, S-O-P-H-E-O-N.com, where you will find plenty of innovation-centric content and corporate best practices. If you'd like to discuss anything with Paul or would like to get in touch with the show, email us at talks@sopheon.com.